disclosure initiative. Rachel or
Ashley on the Okay, so good morning. This morning we will present to you an overview of the feedback we received on the draft practice statement. Just a bit of background on the demographics of the respondents. We met with preparers, auditors, standard setters and users. We've also received comment letters from them. We made a particular effort to reach out to preparers from smaller entities as we thought they might be a group that would benefit the most from the practice statement and don't traditionally have the resources to engage in our comment letter process. So we reached out to them through the World Standard Setters. We also held a webinar in which we discussed the thinking behind the ED, its contents, and then we responded to the participants' specific questions. So moving on to the feedback that we received, there is widespread support for the board to undertake a project that helps preparers apply materiality. We hear that people view materiality as key to solving the disclosure problem, and the majority of respondents thought that the practice statement, as drafted, would be a useful tool in their discussions with auditors. And we also got lots of positive feedback about the document's educational role. There was a general hope expressed that the document would promote discussion about materiality and that this would encourage management to consider it more. And in general, the feedback focused on maximising the usefulness of the practice statement rather than the technical content. So if we look at the specific questions, question one asked people if they were happy to have it as a practice statement, and the majority are in favour of it being a non-mandatory practice statement. The main reason people cited for this was they acknowledged that materiality is already part of IFRS and the practice statement just describes the process in more detail and helps preparers apply it. So they see it as an expansion of a principle that's already in the standards. Those who aren't in favour of the practice statement were mainly worried about the undefined status of a practice statement. They weren't sure how it would fit in with their national frameworks. And they also thought that the fact that it wasn't mandatory would make it difficult for auditors to rely on it discussions with or with preparers to rely on it in their discussions with auditors, and worried that it wouldn't stand up if a case ended up in court. So some people who disagreed with it being a practice statement thought that it should be educational material, whereas others thought that it should be there should be more on materiality in IS1 or the new disclosure standard that comes out of POD, or may come out of POD. Then other people thought that it should be possibly implementation guidance, so working, it would be a similar document but within a framework that people already recognise. So then question two dealt with examples, and the majority of respondents were in favour of using examples. They thought it helped enlighten the document and make it more easy to understand, but they were quite critical of how we've written the examples. They feel that it doesn't cover the grey areas well enough and we need to make it a more practical document. Some people thought it was too simplistic and would benefit from more detail, so we need to demonstrate different aspects of the judgment, like simultaneously, so each decision isn't made in a silo, they're made together, so we should address that. So we asked for specific examples that people would like to see. I think we should thank everyone who wrote back to us, because we now have lots of specific examples to put in the actual practice statement. So then question three dealt with content. In general, people were happy with the technical content of the practice statement. We didn't get that many comments on it. A small minority are worried that the section on omissions and misstatements should belong in IS8. They didn't disagree with it, but they thought that it should be in IS8 rather than in a practice statement in materiality. And we had similar comments about the needs of the primary user. People thought that they agreed it was a good discussion, but they thought it should be in the conceptual framework, because they felt if you were looking for a discussion on primary users, you would look in the conceptual framework and not in a practice statement on materiality. So these two issues we're going to discuss with the board in more detail at a later time, hopefully next month, but maybe. And then the fourth question was to do with timing. So when we proposed the practice statement, we said that we would try and get it out as quickly as possible so that preparers had something that they could deal with while the rest of the disclosure initiative was going on. So we asked people if they were happy with this. And the majority are happy. They feel that if we publish this now, there would be a more immediate effect, and that probably it won't change that much after the finalisation of POD. But a minority of respondents were reluctant to have a practice statement to come out now, and particularly if the definition changes in POD, they felt that this document would come out now, and then in 3 or 4 years they would have to go back and change it all again because the definition had changed. So I think we're going to bring a more detailed discussion on timing as well. So that's it. If anyone has anything to add or if anyone has any questions.
Thank you. It's a very good summary of all the good feedbacks. But just I'm wondering on paragraph 7 on smaller entities. And you have paid a good attention to smaller entities because we thought smaller entities might need a guidance more on this kind of thing. However, you are saying here the results of feedback of smaller entities quite similar to the other entities. So it's a little disappointing because we paid our good attention to them, but there's no big difference in responses. However, maybe I would like to ask there might be some special things from smaller entities compared to the large ones. Can you remember anything?
Well, I think the first thing is that even though the responses were very similar, that was something that we didn't know. We wondered if it would be different. And then the fact that it wasn't different was news to us. So that was a good thing to find out. And also they really appreciated, they didn't realise that they had the capacity to write comment letters, and this had like drawn it to their attention. So I think they really appreciated that, and some of them asked if they could get involved in other projects. So I think that was good. I think what came out from them is that they start talking to their auditors about materiality earlier in the process, and they tended not to... They realised that auditors and preparers have different thresholds of materiality, but there didn't seem to be much of a conversation. They felt that they would go along with what the auditor said because they didn't really have time to go through. They didn't have the resources to go through and fight it that much. But that's what they thought. This document would be helpful, that if they had something to point to, that would be a good thing.
Sure.
I wondered if I could just clarify a couple of the comments on the summary feedback, because I wasn't entirely sure I understood the points that they were making. So it says in here that those who are not in favour of a practice statement noted the undetermined status of the practice statement and were concerned that its non-mandatory status would make it difficult for management to rely on it. Now, I understand the point about mandatory, non-mandatory, but I didn't understand what the undetermined meant, because I thought it was obvious that it was not mandatory, so I just wondered what that meant. And the other thing was, said that some others were of the view that it should be mandatory and argued that it would allow for less bias in the application of the concept, and I wasn't sure why mandatory versus non-mandatory would affect the way that it was applied, so I just wondered if there was a bit more to both of those statements that I was missing.
I think with the undetermined one, the other practice statement that we have is on management commentary, which is outside the IFRS statement, so people thought that this was something that interacted but wasn't IFRS, whereas materiality is part of IFRS, and this confused them and they weren't sure.
So the interaction of mandatory and non-mandatory guidance was what they were sort of worried about?
Yeah, or whether this was a step that the board was taking in introducing more practice statements as opposed to implementation guidance, or where that was. And I think we've considered bringing this to ASAF to discuss with them.
Yeah, so the I guess we already have education type guidance in our standards in the form of implementation guidance, and so some of the comments we got were asked us, well, why don't we put it where we currently have implementation type guidance, why this separate document? Others on the other hand said actually pulling this together in a separate document, because it pulls on information from different standards, was actually a very helpful thing and brought greater clarity to it.
What the word undetermined meant.
I think that's what we weren't sure what it meant either, so we were...
And the bias in application?
Bias in application, I think people thought that while there's no guidance of any sort at the moment, just what it says in IS1, people are open to determine or to interpret it as they want. So there's more variety of interpretations. But having this, even if it's not mandatory, will have a kind of mainstream view, I think is what they were alluding to.
Mary?
First of all, I want to say congratulations. I had a lot of trepidation about issuing this exposure draft because of both the non-mandatory status and because materiality is such a third rail in so many discussions. And I think the general degree, the broad support is a very important and encouraging message. One thing that I think we should think about, maybe not for finalizing the practice statement, but as we think about other stages of the disclosure initiative, is this whole point right up front about this can't be mandatory because of the possibility for conflicts with national regimes. The more I've thought about it, the more I think we're giving credence to something that actually doesn't isn't exist. True.
Yeah.
Because while a national regime could potentially make the determination of materiality tighter than IFRS requires, I think IFRS would still say you have to consider the understandability, and you couldn't make it looser than IFRS requires and still assert compliance with IFRS. So I think we're right to take a cautious step. I don't think we should change horses midstream in terms of the practice statement, but going maybe to what I thought of as my last point is, as we look ahead to finalizing the disclosure initiative and the principles of disclosure and whether or not we might also be revisiting IS1, IS8, and bringing them together, I think we should then consider whether we bring this in as application guidance in the course of that broader project. And I don't see, and that's why I think we should be cautious in finalizing this about giving too much weight to the notion of conflicts with national regimes. In terms of steps to finalize this, I would suggest caution about adding more examples. I think the staff did a really good job in terms of the exposure draft of tying everything back to something authoritative in the standards. And while I can see that the document would be more valuable if we expanded the commentary about examples or added more examples, I think maybe we save that for a phase two, because I think a lot of caution in this area is warranted in what we may think of as a pretty straightforward additional example. If it hasn't been exposed, we might not pick up some of the nuances. So it isn't do none, but I think be very cautious and think about extra soundings before we do a lot of expansion.
I think people would like us to combine the examples that we have. Okay. So rather than have one sentence at the end of one paragraph and then another example at the end of the next paragraph, put them together. So I don't think people wanted new examples.
Okay.
It was like how we presented them.
Okay, it was your comment about people gave lots of ideas for examples, and I thought that meant significantly increasing the number.
Yeah, there were comments about expanding or focusing on the process, the judgment process required to be applied when applying materiality through the examples, and that some people felt that we hadn't captured that aspect of it sufficiently in the examples.
Caution is my bad word on this one.
Mary, you had mentioned about the mandatory, non-mandatory. One of the reasons that came out that people gave in support of the non-mandatory was that applying materiality is a judgment process, and they felt there was potentially a difficulty in giving guidance on how to make that judgment with a mandatory form of guidance. They felt that it fitted better with a non-mandatory guidance. So that was just another reason some people gave us a support.
Maybe because it's new, that has think of it that way, it has a bit more resonance with me, but I just don't want us to overplay the, we couldn't possibly because of concern about conflict with national regimes.
I need to not overplay it. I think it's not a valid argument.
Yeah.
And in fact, a number
of people. And you haven't found any examples except for one or so.
That's right. Many people said they didn't see a conflict with their national laws or regulations.
Yeah, so I would take away that argument completely, and then the fact, and then the question remains, why not mandatory?
Or why not at least captured in
the
mainstream?
The fact that you need to use judgment, yeah, that's the whole basis of IFRS. So
it's in IS1 anyway.
Yeah, I don't think there are really strong arguments, and you know, this. I think the main reason was that we wanted to have a bit freer form in which we do this. Either educational material, where we, but that's always difficult, where we, which we use because we want form-free educational material, or I would say mandatory, but by a practice statement. There's a lot for management commentary. We have done that, but there we have had a good reason because we are not really. It's not part of our remit to make big management commentary. Materiality is in the heart of our remit, so I'm not so sure about it.
Well, Hans, just one thing. I think we talk about mandatory, non-mandatory, when I think we may mean standalone or integrated as part of the standards and the guidance on them. And the reason I make that distinction is a lot of the illustrative examples are integrated into the standards. They're in here, but they're not mandatory. So I'm asking you to think about whether you really mean mandatory or incorporated into the standards and their guidance.
Well, I'm open for discussion, but I think we were wrong-footed by that one argument. Steve.
I agree, Hans. I think we did it because of what we previously thought of the regulatory side of this, and given the feedback, I think we should seriously reconsider the form of the document, and we should consider that it should be application guidance, mandatory, with examples which are non-mandatory, in the same way that we do for all other standards. And anything that we can do to give it more prominence, I think, would be good from the point of view of getting people to seriously take into account materiality. And if we can have it more prominent, mandatory, whatever, then I think that would be a good move.
Gary?
Thank you. A couple of thoughts, including some of which we've touched on, but firstly, it's a very readable paper that you put together. It was easy to get through and grasp what you wanted. I think on the undetermined status and mandatory or non-mandatory, I mean, given my preferences, I actually would lean a little bit more towards going for mandatory. And we don't have to make that decision now, but if you needed an inclination of where people around the room were thinking, that's where I would be. Yes, maybe it has to get reformatted and, you know, written a little bit differently. But I think we can ultimately decide that for later. I do think, however it's written, is, let's say we go non-mandatory, I think we want it written and structured in such a way that if a national standard setter or an auditing regulator wanted to lift it into the local regime, that they could lift it as written as is. And actually, even if we go non-mandatory, my instincts tells me there's going to be snippets inside of here. We might want to drop them to 1 or 8 or 7 or some other place. That, even if it goes non-mandatory, it still comes across to me as this is the best thinking by the International Accounting Standards Setters, presumably one of the best and brightest of counsel. This is how we think materiality should be looked at. I don't think it can be ignored. I think being formally issued through due process, it's got an elevated status relative to educational materials. And I think on education materials, it kind of a little bit where Mary is, maybe a little bit less examples rather than more, but doesn't mean we can't take all the other examples and put them in education materials either. It doesn't. It's not a binary only decision. A couple of important points going forward. I think early in the redeliberations, and we could do it either through here, we could do it through the conceptual framework, but right now with IS1, the conceptual framework, document, the conceptual learning exposure draft, and the practice, and we've got multiple slightly different iterations of the definition materiality. We absolutely do have to harmonize them. And I would suggest, whether, like, presumably the conceptual framework, you know, work coming forward ahead of this, but I think that should be done sooner rather than later, and if we have to amend IS-1 for that, so be it. And, of course, we can work the practice statement, which will be allowed for that sound, but I think it's absolutely critical. And then, lastly, it's on paragraph 27, about expressed concerns about the guidance and prior period errors. As you know, that's what I consider the weakest section in there. Most of it doesn't go far enough. And I just ask, maybe we spend some serious time at a board advisors meeting on that. And again, it's not the material errors, it's what you do with all the little stuff. Because I think we need closure on that. As you know, we don't have that in there.
Peter?
I'd like to comment on the request for more sophisticated examples. I think if we can produce examples that illustrate well the thought process, that's a very good thing. But we often get these requests for less simplistic examples that illustrate more clearly the judgments. Those examples are incredibly difficult to write in a way that's going to be useful to people. So I think we just need to be cautious about that.
Yes. Wiggle.
From beginning, I never thought we would produce a mandatory document for this topic. And so I still feel, a non-mandatory document is the most appropriate. But the question Hans raised, it seems, Hans, frankly, is quite funny. We never clearly defined the status of practice statement, the different from education material, and because we never defined the different levels of education material that are non-mandatory. And so from us, we want to challenge us, so unclearness of practice statement, it seems quite odd. My question to those who want to convert this into mandatory are two, or the staff can answer me. That is, if we want to convert into mandatory, whether we want to keep the whole content roughly the same or want to have a short version, fit into the standards. If the second, whether we will face a tremendous, either way, the whole content roughly the same or a condensed one, whether we'll face tremendous pushback from our constituencies, because the staff already put us, most people or majority people support the status of this document.
Oh, that's a good question, of course. If we switch opinions, how will people react? Philippe.
Thank you. Three points. First, as Peter, I feel a bit in doubt about the additional examples. I think it's good to try to improve the way we explain the thought process, but I'm a bit cautious about adding new examples more detailed, because people will try to push their own case and get a confirmation through an example of what is their judgment. So we have to be very careful in adding new examples. I would like the staff to comment specifically on the views of regulators and enforcement authorities regarding this document, because in reading the paper, I did not find any specific mention of what reaction the regulators and enforcement authorities had to this proposal, and especially on the issue of the status of the document, practice statement, or mandatory. And last, I think before we make any decision on the status of the document, on which I have no strong views, I think we need to think and have legal advice and maybe an early reaction from those charged with endorsement. Because I remember that when, in 2005, the Commission decided not to endorse the conceptual framework, it was for legal reasons, because the status of such a document was considered to be not endorsable in a legal framework. I'm a bit afraid that this kind of document about materiality could have the same difficulties regarding a legal endorsement. So I think before we undertake any move, we need to be relatively sure that it will not end up in being something that people say, well, I find that we can't endorse it because the status, the nature of the document, the contents are not of a legal nature. So let's be careful before we make any decision.
Maru?
Thanks, Hans. Just guess at this point, reinforce some views already expressed at the round table. At inception, my position was that was not really necessary because it was already everything that we have this is already encompassed in our literature. And then when we advanced in the discussion, I was, say, Camp as Wegu, was really agreeing with practice statement as an offset. However, following the experience of Brazilians that issued some kind of practice statement even before we did it, much shorter version, but based on IFRS, and the success of this in the Brazilian case, because immediately after the issuance by the standard setters, the Securities Commission endorsed it. And why? Because of the same reasons expressed here by others, that it might be the best way to have this observed as expected. So on balance, I'm like Philippe, I have at this point no strong views. However, I'm leaning towards, as Hans and Steve expressed, I'm leaning towards and I'm willing to discuss the possibility of having this included in our literature. I think at the end of the day could be very positive in terms of our applying materiality principles within our literature if it is endorsed by authorities around the world. So I think it's a good idea for us to rethink the status of the document.
Could the staff reply to the question about what regulators specifically said about this document?
Yes, so we didn't get a lot. We did get some letters, but not a lot from regulators. And most of them commented that they think this would be useful for preparers, but didn't comment on the relationship between the regulators and the preparers. I don't think we got any saying that they would endorse it automatically, although I have heard one or two, but not from letters.
Well, this is my concern, that if we make it a mandatory statement, a mandatory document, then the ones who will be tasked with the application will be regulators, enforcers, and maybe courts of justice later on. Courts of justice, there might be a legal regime, whether it clashes or not, whether it takes precedence, we discuss it. But whether the regulators will feel comfortable in the application of a document seen as mandatory, this is very important for us to know that.
Yeah, although I don't really see why not. I mean, I don't see the comparison with the conceptual framework very much, to tell you the truth.
No, I mean, okay, conceptual was one case, this one may be a different case, but I think in deciding whether we make it mandatory, we need to know what will be the situation in the endorsement process. Because it'd be stupid to do it and then to find out that they can't end up.
It's not a bad idea to get a specific opinion of the regulators.
And the endorsement process in various countries where there is an endorsement process is something they could endorse because of the nature of the document.
Thank you. Just a due process question. So suppose we are not going to change any single word of this document, but we would like to change the status of this document. Do we need another go-around of exposure?
Not if we think we've got the information we need to make the decision, because we already asked about mandatory, non-mandatory, so we've got feedback on that, right? That's our criteria, right? Are we going to get new information by re-exposing?
Well, except that we proposed it and got feedback that, in general, I think was supportive of non-mandatory, and if it's non-mandatory, people who might have been concerned if it was mandatory wouldn't necessarily have responded.
Maybe I should rephrase it. We'd need to look at the arguments we got to see if we thought that it gave us the information we'd need to understand.
But it is a bit tricky.
Yeah, because following Rego's comment, if it was mandatory, then people's reaction might be different. Could be different.
That's my only reason to not have strong feelings.
Yeah, so therefore, so current document itself is strongly supported by many constituents. And if we go have another round, then it may deteriorate the process, and then we would lose the chance to provide good documents in the market. So I disagree with going to mandatory. We keep it as a practice statement.
Because mandatory, just a question for you, mandatory means that we'll need to re-expose as a proposal address, right? Because it's a different document, it's a different process.
It's a completely different due process.
Wouldn't it be part of IS1 in that case?
Yeah.
I think one other thing we'd need to consider is whether people might have commented who didn't, if they'd known it's mandatory. I mean, looking at this, we got 96 comment letters, which is a bit on the low side for what would be possibly a major document.
Sue?
Some people that seem to have expressed quite strong views in terms of mandatory, non-mandatory, and I don't have enough information based on this analysis to change my mind in either direction, because it's only a summary, so it's only very high level. I think when we look at mandatory, non-mandatory, one of the things I'd like to understand, building a little bit on what Philippe was saying, was what's really the consequence of the difference between those two things, both in terms of some of these endorsement issues, but what it means for a lawyer if they were to pick up the document if it ever gets to court, which is the sort of situation where the rubber really hits the road with this type of stuff. But to me, we already had the concept of materiality in our literature, so we already require people to apply materiality when they use our standards anyway. All of this, to me, was really doing was saying, you know, this is how you think about judgments and making that assessment. It wasn't really changing our requirements as such. And even if we made it mandatory, I'm not sure how much of a difference it really makes in terms of how can I really put somebody's feet to the fire and say, did you use judgment, which is really what that document's saying. And a lot of sophisticated preparers who I spoke to sort of unsurprisingly said nothing in the document was news to them. And that doesn't surprise us, and that doesn't mean it's not a good document, because it's still helping other people who aren't as sophisticated. But if it's really just sort of, in a sense, helping people understand what many of us thought was obvious, what's really the consequence of making it mandatory versus non-mandatory? And that's what I'd really like to understand. And what does it mean in a regulator's hands if it makes it mandatory versus non-mandatory? I'd really just like to understand what the real practical consequence is of that difference in label.
That document, the whole thing, or what is left, the outcome, would become a piece of legislation.
I know.
All right. So,
but if all that legislation says, really, in summary, is applied
judgment. There is a concept, which is a legislation. Now, if you attach 20 pages to a concept, it's a bit a different story.
Well, personally, I was always in the non-mandatory camp, because I think because of its style, it lends itself to that. But if people now are going to start thinking that somehow by making it mandatory, it's going to be much, the application is going to be better, and it's going to be, I still don't understand it, but somehow less biased in its application, these types of statements. I really want to understand why people think the effect's going to be so different.
Wego?
Can I further clarify what I questioned? You know, I say, you know, for those who want to convert into mandatory or the staff, we have to think about what the final version will be. If we convert into simpler version written in a way which very similar to our standards, then people come back and say, the reason why we support the original document is because the original document, the exposure chapter, provides more guidance for us, even though it is educational, is non-mandatory. But from that document, I learn a lot, know how to improve my, you know, judgment on materiality. Now, this is one side. They say, no, you should not change, you know, into a short version. And then if we keep basically the same, even extend more, and then people say, from beginning, the reason why we support is because it is non-mandatory. Mm-hmm. You know, now you keep non-mandatory documents exposed into, you know, mandatory ones, may people have to totally against us. You know, this is my concern. You know.
Martin?
When, Similar like Sue, because I find it difficult to understand what it means if he makes this mandatory. One example in this practice statement in paragraph 34, we speak about immaterial information and stating that providing immaterial information may be make financial statements less understandable. If that is mandatory, what does it mean for a regulator?
It's NIS 1 now.
What does it mean if it's that saying? Because if that is mandatory, but we're saying, okay, it is not prohibited to provide immaterial information, I see a conflict. Because currently, I think regulators say, if you provide immaterial information, I think it is not against IFRS. It's clearly less understandable. But if we make this document mandatory, I find it difficult then, what does that mean? And I have to learn more if what are the consequences, how regulators will see that, how auditors will see that. And also, based on feedback I heard, it is at least from more sophisticated, it is nothing new in that. And really the more sophisticated said, okay, that is maybe a little bit too simple to really helpful. And based on that feedback to make that mandatory, I don't know.
That was my single biggest concern about this document. The notion that in a day and age where you can publish a 3,000 page annual report, put it all on the web, someone could assert that you have distorted my picture, my perception of your company because you've overloaded me with information. I can either choose to go and retrieve that and study it, or I can choose not to. Okay, so to me, the issue you've identified is very, very critical to get resolved and nailed down. Because I don't see a single investor ever complaining about too much information. They either choose to use it or they choose not to.
I'm a bit along Sue's lines. We're not asked to make a decision together here, and the discussion's good, and I think it's good that people are saying what they think, but it says the majority of respondents favour non-mandatory, that's number. I'd like to know what sort of majority and who, and that's what the staff are offering, is to bring back a more in-depth analysis of who wants mandatory and who doesn't and why. And so this is very much an overview, and as I say, it's good people are expressing their opinions, but we're not reaching a decision today.
No, but we are giving the staff some angles to think about. Mary.
Wanted to come back because I expressed some enthusiasm about looking at incorporating it into our guidance and, you know, our standards, including accompanying material. I think that should be our long-term objective. I don't think we should get so excited by the degree of agreement with our proposals, which is a nice feeling. We don't often get, you know, this kind of level of support that we screw up finalizing the first step. So I, in terms of feedback to the staff about what to bring back, what to explore as we move forward, I would be of the mind that we try to finalize the practice statement, but having had this feedback, given that we have several other strands of work that look at materiality, look at whether we would then, in essence, upgrade it in connection with other work we're doing to pull it together. I'm not trying to shut down the discussion, but I think it could be challenging to try and have a deliberation, even if the staff goes back and analyzes responses and comes back when we exposed it as non-mandatory and people gave us comments or decided not to comment in that context.
Chang Wu.
Thank you. Yes, I remember this package is we approached it in two ways. One is some kind of refining the definition of materiality in a disclosure, maybe initiative. Another one is we are providing some kind of a kind of educational guidance as a form of this practice statement. There was a kind of, I remember, there's a kind of a structure we have approached this issue. So we have to think about that, the whole picture on this issue. So another thing is if we touch the state of this practice statement as Tak has suggested, we might need another round of exposure draft. And also we need a kind of a many board members have suggested already, if we are going to make this statement as a mandatory, then we need a big change in the the content over here and the structure over here. So it'll be another big project, you know. So maybe as Ian has suggested, you are going to bring back the opinions on the status, then you might have to bring back another how to tackle with this practice statement as a mandatory statement, with considering that the change of our definition of materiality, so whole package we should see, and mm-hmm. whether we should decide whether this is mandatory or not. So that's the one suggestion.
Okay. Well, I think we have discussed this sufficiently. Shall we move on to the next?
Thank you.
So good morning, everyone. It's agenda paper 11B, disclosures about restrictions on cash and liquidity as well. So just as a background, in December 2014, the board published the IS7 amendments exposure draft, which included two proposals, one for the disclosure of a reconciliation and one for the disclosure of cash restrictions. Then in October 2015, the board decided to finalize a reconciliation on a standalone basis and decided to wait and further test the proposals represented in that paper, the October paper. And also, the board decided that we should take the feedback from the agenda consultation on whatever they said about liquidity disclosures and other types of information that relates related to the cash restrictions to see how to deal with this, with both issues moving on. So the purpose of this paper is to provide the board information to decide at a future meeting if the board wants to add a new project on liquidity disclosures, and what will be the fate of the cash restrictions disclosures, if it should be together in that project, if we go on a standalone project, or if we would drop it or other decision. So we're not seeking any decisions at this meeting. So in the first part of the paper, we simply remind the board what were the disclosure draft proposals on the IS7 amendments. And what was the feedback that we received on that exposure draft? So we provide that first section of the paper as a refreshment on what people have said at the time. On the second part, we provide some of the agenda consultation feedback. There was no specific question on the agenda consultation, just as a reminder regarding liquidity disclosures or regarding the cash restriction proposals. But even so, we did receive feedback on those issues. Because the feedback we got from both was mostly from investors, most of the feedback in this that we discussed in this paper was also kind of reflected in the paper that you discussed yesterday on the investor feedback. So investors have requested more information about liquidity and more information about the availability of cash. Those requests, we try to summarize them on page 5 and 6 of the paper. We also wanted to update the board on what the FASB has done on liquidity disclosures based on an exposure draft that they published in 2012. We give emphasis in the paper to one of the proposals. There were several, not only about liquidity, but also about interest rate risk disclosures. And one of the proposals that they called available liquid funds. In paragraph 24, we quote from the exposure draft a requirement to disclose a narrative discussion about the effect of regulatory, tax, legal, repatriation, and other conditions that could limit the transferability of funds. That was the expression that they use. Limit the transferability of funds among the entity. That project was not finalized, and we understand that the FASB has no current plans to finalize it now. Finally, we also wanted to include at the last part of the paper, part of the research that we have conducted so far on the issue of cash restrictions, which is related to investors' needs. So in paragraph 26, we have included what we think investors are looking for, try to really assess during this time since the end of the finalization of the IS7 amendments, what is actually really what investors are looking for with this information. And we basically think that they're looking for two different things that are related but are different. How much cash is free in terms of cost, not in terms of restriction, but how much cash is free to pay existing debt, and how much cash is free to be used strategically. And we've set up some examples in the paper, what would be that strategic. So those are the discussion we wanted to provide the board with information.
Doc.
Yes, I think that this is important, and I think we should continue. And, but I would suggest to make it more comprehensive rather than just stick to the restrictions. Actually, cash on the consolidated financial statement is really misleading. So that is my concern. So cash must be the fact, whereas consolidated financial statement tells the story of performance and the status of the comprehensive situation of the company. So therefore, in order to say it is a cash, it would mislead the people. There is a actual cash in the safe, but we don't have any cash in the safe of parent company. However, each management have their own strategy how to deal with the liquidity issue. So let's ask management to tell their story or their strategy about liquidity management. That is very important. And also to provide the fact how much actual cash is there in each jurisdiction or country. So someone provided to show the table of country by country cash balance. That would provide very good information to the investors. So I strongly support to continue this project.
Pat?
I would like to support and echo Tuck's observations. I think the one thing that I would hope that the board doesn't do is find a way to push out the analysis of this area and create an opportunity to say this is a part of a major project that will undertake over many, many years, as opposed to kind of harvesting, I think, which is relatively clearly identifiable information that investors have said in the past that they would like to have. And there's a lot of different ways we can do that, but I think as standard setters, we seem to find a way to defer and push things out, and that's one concern I have. The other footnote I would put on this is some of you, I'm sure, are aware of a concept release that the SEC published last Wednesday. It's a 340-page PDF document. It essentially is a tour de force on all of the issues that they are going to be examining in the area of disclosure and revamping their rules, their guidance on disclosure. I definitely would commend it to everybody's attention, particularly the Disclosure Initiative team. There are some key areas in there, and some of the questions that the document touches on are exactly the ones that we're talking about here. Disclosures around restrictions dealing with cash, impact on liquidity, capital structure, and what have you. So I think that work is going to just spur other standard setters, other regulatory bodies to examine the same thing. So if we push this off, we're not going to be thought leaders in the area. We're going to be following. And I think the ISB should be setting the ground work and the foundation for this so that regulators around the world don't have to do that. In other words, essentially, we'll create the guidance and everybody else will follow along if we do a comprehensive good job. So I'd say let's have at it. Yeah,
sure. Mary?
I think it would be good to pursue the piece of the project that we dropped off of the gross cash reconciliation amendment that we issued late last year.
January.
Okay, early this year. I would be supportive of incorporating it into a larger project that looked at related issues if we were committed to, if we decide to commit to such a larger project. I don't want to put it in that and then say don't do it and so we lose this. So I'd say let's talk about the follow-up separately, and then if we see something that it relates to that we are pursuing, think about moving it into that. Yeah, you know, rather than doing it the other way around. The other thing that I want to flag is, in here we seem to have gone back to the language which I think is used casually in practice in discussion about restrictions on cash, and I thought one of the aha moments that we had as we were trying to finalize some commentary is that we wanted to move beyond legal restrictions, you cannot do this unless you get permission, to identifying significant economic disincentives.
Yes.
And making sure we don't forget that broader aspect.
Gary.
Yeah, quickly. It, like most of the other speakers, actually support going forward with this, whether, you know, particularly or mostly along the lines of the work we've done to date. It, I think a much larger project on overall liquidity and capital and funding strategy is a different beast, and I think that's got take a long time to do. I would say, kind of, with what we've worked on so far, maybe a little what we've learned more recently. I think we finish it. I think I personally don't believe accounting standards that has put enough emphasis on liquidity type disclosures. A lot of it's all on determination net income. I think ultimately you stay in business if you're liquid. Yet, and I don't think there's enough of that. As I look through, I mean, it seems like investors, regulators, national standard setters, accountancy bodies recommend we do it. I don't think it, going to paragraph 12, even the preparers raise concerns about the usefulness, not necessarily about the cost or ability to do. So I know this can be done. And I wouldn't wait for the principles disclosure project, because that's, we're talking years. We're only talking DM or DP coming out on that. So I think we should go ahead and finalize it is separately. We're on a bigger project on liquidity. We'll deal with that. Outside.
I thought we don't discuss it, because that is said in page 1.
Can I just, I feel like a witch at this board meeting. I really do. And I apologize if I come across as a witch. But I just don't understand how we keep getting into this discussion about, I think this is a project we should be doing and this should be its scope, because the staff rightly are not even asking us for that question in this paper, they're just sort of informing us, because aren't we going to in May or some point in time look at all of the requests and try and look at projects side by side?
Yes.
And I'm just worried, we keep having these discussions that people might be listening to where board members are saying, I support a project of X scope.
Yeah.
We can't do that this week, can we?
I think that is the concern I want to express. I think, I mean, a broad project on liquidity sounds very interesting. It sounds very useful to all our constituents. But we get in the end, we are having to look at this in the context of our broader agenda consultation, and it's not.
And
clear
there might
to
be some quick wins. So there might be some ways we can pull bits out, even with resource constraints. But I'm a bit worried about the messages we're sending.
So I guess we should. And it was a bit like the previous discussion, try and restrain ourselves to asking questions about what the responses were or getting things clearer, and be patient and wait for next month before making comments on whether we think it's a good thing or a bad thing.
Yeah, there's a lot of analysis that we have done on this issue that is more detailed, and I was not commenting on those analysis to respond to some of the comments that the board made, because I think we would bring something more detailed on a future meeting.
Okay, very good.
Three points. Firstly, you know, Taka may answer my question. You say that, you know, provide a national-based, country-based, the limit on the.
But we're not discussing that today.
He suggests I want to be.
Yeah, but
he
was a bit out of line suggesting it. So let's keep it to.
I offer my query. You know. Taka, I'm not sure whether it is within the segmental reporting, you know, regime, or you want to add another layer of disclosure.
Possibly another layer, but
yeah. And secondly, you know, for those who want to have a comprehensive liquidity disclosure, I think one thing we have to keep in mind.
We're going to discuss that next month, whether we want more disclosure. We're not debating that now. We're talking about what's in this paper and what information's being provided. That's what we've all just agreed.
I'm not sure. And that's Ms. Lloyd's opinion, but that's not my opinion.
Do you think that the market's well served if somebody's listening and we're all sitting here saying we want to do this really big broad scope project, and then next month we turn around and say we'd love to do that project, but unfortunately we can't because of all of our other priorities?
Well, to some extent, though, our agenda, I think we have to acknowledge, is a function of the times, and the times are changing.
But nobody...
That's next month's discussion.
I don't disagree.
Okay, so then let's move on.
Well, it's difficult to speak given the constraints you're putting, but having heard my colleagues, I think it's an important area. It's an important topic, and it's a difficult one. So the balancing act will be difficult. To achieve progress in providing useful information at a reasonable cost that is acceptable. That's always our constraints in doing standard setting. I have a question to the staff, actually. All this matter is all about disaggregating information within a set of consolidated financial statements. Because consolidated financial statements are useful, but they can hide or not provide information about how the constituents of this consolidation work. So it's all about what's inside the set of consolidated financial statements, how the mechanics inside the body work. We are due to undertake a post-implementation review of IFRS 12. IFRS 12 was our first attempt at providing more information about the constituents of a set of consolidated financial statements, disclosures about key figures for subsidiaries, associates, etc. So how are we going to link that discussion here with IFRS 12 PIR? Is there any link? Can we see? Because, for instance, it's very useful to give a snapshot picture about cash and liquidity at a certain point in time. What about the cash flows that create this cash? Currently, we give a view of the consolidated cash flows. It might be that 50% of those cash flows go out of the group because of NCIs. Is that the kind of things we also want to consider, or do we only focus on the snapshot picture? So I think this kind of discussion, I think we need to see it in maybe a broader context of what information is useful about the workings of a group, inside workings, internal workings.
Yeah, one of the things we will have to decide in the future is where to place this project, this on cash and etc. So one of the options could be decide if it's going to be on a post-implementation, because we don't think, after the feedback we received, we don't think it would be, IS7 might not be the place for it, because it was exposed as IS7 amendments. So one of the things would be to decide where to put it.
One of the things I'd be interested in when we look at this again would be, if my memory serves me well, we're already doing some work with the UK FRC on cash flow statements, cash some description, can't remember the scope. What I'd be interested is how much is already, that's in here, it might already be covered by some of that work that would already be feeding in. Also, I think the other thing that would be good to think about, and I don't know yet what sort of staff are going to tell us about resources and priorities and things coming forward, but what is interesting and comes through quite strongly in the feedback from investors in particular, but also from others, is that it seems to take us an awful lot of long time sometimes to sort of get any results. And I think investors often feel like it takes forever to get improvements in the information they get. What I think is really helpful in the feedback we've got from investors is some quite practical suggestions that aren't really very conceptual or difficult, like maturity analysis, this type of stuff.
Exactly.
And what would be good to think about, I think, in terms of what would be the sort of maximum bang for our buck, given the resources and time we've got available, what are some smart ways that we might be able to pick bits and pieces out that could be potentially, we hope, quick wins that would be quite visible and easily achievable within the context of some of the bigger, longer projects that take more resources. And I think there could be some bits and pieces maybe we could do there.
Just in terms of the FRC's work on cash flows, I think there are some clear overlaps between that work and the sort of disclosures that we were looking at in this area. And certainly if we're looking at the thing in a sort of broader context, it would be within something to do with the cash flow statement, I think. It might fit quite nicely in there.
And I certainly do agree with Pat in terms of the sense that I think we hear repeatedly lots of frustrations on these types of issues. Certainly every time you pick up the paper, there's stuff about tax structuring and money being locked in different jurisdictions. It's very topical. So I think we should be thinking about that when we're thinking about our prioritisation, because I think it is a relatively urgent to some.
Okay. Can I just comment on what we might bring you for May for the agenda consultation discussion? Because it seems to me that there seems to be some interest in not dropping this topic, but the big question is, where do we not drop it? So at one extreme, we would take a very broad look in, for example, primary financial statements or something, which obviously there's a lot of scoping still to be done on that. The other option would be to pursue some sort of quick wins. But of course, the problem we had last year and the reason we didn't finalise it last year was we came to the conclusion we need some sort of broader context before we could really know the best way forward. So my presumption is that by the time you discuss this in May, we'll probably not know enough to give you a clear picture of whether there are feasible quick wins or not. We'd probably, I suspect, need to do more work to establish whether that's likely. Eduardo may tell me I'm wrong and that we've already identified quick wins, but I suspect the decision you make in May may well have to be, if you want to think about quick wins, that we'd need to have to do some work, more work first to establish whether there is something available.
All right.